It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, the power of play. When I was little, my sister and I used to spend a lot of the summer outdoors, riding around on our bikes, catching fireflies, or just lying on blankets under trees, reading and talking and playing card games. I bet you have memories like that too. Maybe of a time in your life when it seemed like all you had to do was play. Well, new research suggests that tag and hopscotch and all the other ways we played as kids actually taught us the skills that we use as adults every day. How to manage conflict, deal with fear, form relationships. Play is how we train for adulthood. And that's good. But psychologist Peter Gray is worried that kids today are playing less, even a lot less, than we did.
Yes, there's no doubt they are definitely playing less than previous generations. I should probably, to make my answer clear, say something about what play is. When I say playing less, I mean that there is less of what other people might call free play. But to me, free play is play. They're playing less on their own. They're playing less in ways where they are controlling and directing the play, where they're making their own choices, solving their own problems, where they, not adults, are determining from moment to moment what they're doing.
So I take it Little League, youth soccer leagues, karate classes, these, you don't count these as play?
These are not play by this definition. And you know, I can elaborate on this, but there's a dramatic difference in what children learn in those kinds of adult-directed sports and activities compared to the activities that they choose and direct themselves.
Like what? What's the difference in what kids learn?
Well, the big difference is this, that when you are playing, when you are in control of your activities, when you must make the decisions, you learn how to do all those things. You learn how to make decisions. You learn how to control your own behavior because there's no adult controlling it. You learn how to get along with your peers as equals because there's no adult solving your problems. You, as a child, are innately motivated to want to play with other kids. So a natural punishment, if you will, for bullying or for not paying attention to what the other kids want and need is that they won't play with you. And that's how children learn, well, wait a minute, I've got to pay attention to this other person's needs.
It's interesting because there's been a lot written over the years about the importance of play for very young children, preschool kids, for instance, the importance of imaginative play, art play, sensory play. But we don't talk that much about play for older kids when you get to school age, junior high, high school.
That's exactly right. And I think that's because of certain cultural blinders we have. You know, I've seen developmental psychology textbooks where the early years up to about age 4 or 5 are called the play years. And then you begin to use other terms to talk about children as they get older. We have this concept that children play until they start school. You don't have to go very far back in even our history, even the history that I've lived, to see that, in fact, children continue to play right on through their teenage years. Adults play if they have the opportunity. But when people are free to play, and they continue learning through play.
Hmm. There's an example in your book that I haven't been able to get out of my mind that I wanted to ask you about. You tell the story about how children played during the Holocaust in concentration camps. It's kind of remarkable and also really illustrates that point we were getting at about the difference between how kids want to play and what parents think play is or should be.
There are two morals of that story. This comes from a book by George Emblin that I was referring to called Children and Play in the Holocaust. And he did studies of diaries and interviews of Holocaust concentration camp survivors. And the remarkable thing he discovered is that even under those horrid conditions, children who were physically strong enough to play, played. And they played not at games designed to escape their horrid conditions, but designed to deal with their horrid conditions. They played at things like crematorium, where they would throw rocks and scream like the screams they heard in the distance, and so on. They played at games that allowed them to understand and embrace and somehow deal emotionally and physically with the horrid situation in which they're in. And so what this shows, first of all, is play is such a strong drive that you do it even when you're hungry, even when you're physically weak. It's such a strong drive in children, such a strong need. And secondly, that play for children is not an escape from the real world. It's a way of dealing with the real world. That's really what play is about. Play is children's incorporating into a kind of fantasy world the realities that are around them. And in the fantasy world, they can deal with these realities and they can practice dealing with these realities so that they can deal better with them in the real world.
And what are the consequences for kids themselves? I mean, if young people today have less and less time to devote to free play, are we seeing any results?
I think we're seeing very serious consequences of it. So let me describe what I've found looking historically. So over the last 50 to 60 years, we have seen a continuous decline in children's freedom to play. Over this same period of time, we've seen a continuous, gradual, but ultimately dramatic increase in all sorts of mental disorders in children and young adults. It's not just that we are identifying disorders that we didn't know to look for before, or that we've changed the definition of disorders. Even by standard clinical questionnaires that have been given in unchanged form to normative samples of children, teenagers, and young adults over the years, there is a dramatic increase in anxiety disorders, in major depression. Major depression and anxiety disorders, by today's criteria, are now 5 to 8 times more prevalent among young people than they were in the 1950s. And this change has been gradual. Suicide rate is 4 times now what it was in the 1950s for children under age 15. And something like 2.5 times what it was then for young people between age 15 and 24.
I'm curious, what makes you think that those higher rates of anxiety and depression are because of how we treat children in schools versus, I don't know, more stress at home, economic stress to career or working couples?
This is a good question. So what I've described is a correlation. There's been a continuous decline in play and a continuous increase in all kinds of mental disorders. There's no relationship between this change in mental disorders and economic stress. Children are far more depressed today than they were during the Great Depression. Adults are far less depressed today than they were during the Great Depression. Children are far more anxious today than they were during the Cold War. You know, I remember the days when we were continuously being warned that the Russians were going to bomb us any time, and we were protecting ourselves, crawling under our desks, and so on and so forth. You know, but children are affected by their real immediate lives and primarily by their friends. We overemphasize how much children are affected by their parents. I don't want to negate the value of parents. Of course, good enough parenting is important. But ask any child, and what is the child's concern, assuming the parents are good enough? The child's primary concern is friends, getting along with other kids, playing with other kids, having control over his or her life. There's every reason to believe that the lack of that is going to cause anxiety and depression. The lack of the opportunity to learn how to control your own life and feel you're in control results in what is called an external sense of control rather than an internal sense of control, a feeling that you are a victim of fate. And there's a standardized questionnaire for that. And over time period, young people have increasingly felt that they are increasingly victims of the world around them and have less and less responded to this questionnaire in a way indicating that they're in control of their life. We know from clinical research that people who don't have this internal sense of control are prone for anxiety and depression.
Peter, you've painted this kind of chilling portrait of a generation of play-starved, anxious, depressed children. What's going to happen when they become adults? What does a generation of play-starved adults look like?
That's a really interesting question. And I think to some degree, we're beginning to see that a little bit. You know, we're beginning to see anxiety. We're beginning to see among adults less hobbies, less looking for fun in family life, and I think less joy, more of a materialistic approach to the world, less of a search for meaning and finding value. I mean, play is all about meaning in a way. It's all about what is it that I really want to do? You know, the child playing is creating the world as he or she wants it to be, rather than simply adjusting to the world as it is. And so the adults who don't grow up playing don't approach the world with the sense, I want to change the world to be the kind of place I want it to be. They grow up with this more anxious sense of, oh, this is the scary world here. How do I adapt to it?
Peter Gray is a professor at Boston College and the author of Free to Learn. So let's say you wanted to design a perfect playground for your neighborhood school. What kind of state-of-the-art equipment would you install? What would it look like? We asked the experts.
My name is Tess McGlenn, and I go to Marquette Elementary School. I think it would have a bunch of floors, like 10 floors. And like there would be a slide on the top floor, and then you could go down it, and it was swirly, so it went around the whole playground. So that's how you would do tours. And I think it'd be pretty cool to have a water slide, even if it's a playground, but it's kind of impossible. There could be like a grassy area, and there would be padding under it, so it would be fake grass and padding, and you could do like cartwheels, and there would be like picnic tables, so you could eat your lunch if you wanted to have a picnic. My name is Ava Davenport, and I go to Marquette. I would probably have a lot of tire swings and a lot of normal swings. And then there would be a lot of monkey bars that went like from the top of the playground to like the bottom of it. There could be like trampolines that you could like jump on if you fell. Maybe places you could like climb up on like nets and then do like a flip down.
I'm Odin Monroe Kane and I go to Marquette. Well, it'll be really, really big. It would take like a whole football field. Like you could go on the bottom of it, little tunnels. Like you get from one place to another. And it'll be made out of candy. And there'll be just thing of monkey bars where like the monkey bars would be like all sticky, so it'd be really hard to go. And if you did it, you get like some prize. There would be like a water fountain instead of it, like had soda instead of a water fountain, and like instead of healthy snacks like candy and stuff would come out.
Yeah, I want that in my neighborhood too. That was Tess McGlynn, Ava Davenport, and Odin Monroe Kane, grade schoolers at Marquette Elementary in Madison. Coming up, we're going to take a look at what's been called the strangest playground on Earth.
Yeah, we let children play with fire. And I think it's an element that some adults struggle with, but the majority of children are fascinated by it. And hopefully, by providing that opportunity to interact with fire, we're actually enabling them to gain a greater understanding and also respect. You know, a burnt finger now may prevent a more serious accident in later life.
Playing with fire. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about the power of play in this hour. And in a small town in northern Wales, there's a wild kind of playground. Wild as in a little uncivilized. It's a place where it's normal to see mud-covered kids playing with rusty tools or crowded around a bonfire with pretty minimal adult supervision. People call this place the Land, and it's one of a handful of adventure playgrounds where kids are free to be kids. Claire Griffiths manages the Land. She described it to Sarah Nix.
The playground is possibly not the most aesthetically pleasing, but it exists to please children, not adults. So on the Land, you'll find items which range from a wooden pallet to a tiny toy rabbit to something you'd have to really explore in to find.
Describe, if you would, what it's like when a kid who's never been to the Land before comes there to play.
When children walk onto the Land, they get it. I believe that, you know, they're like programmed to play in a certain way. And a child will walk onto the Land and you can see that there's excitement. They're inquisitive and they're curious and they'll explore.
And so what are some of the things that the kids build, say, out of all the loose tumble of equipment there?
They build hotels, they build little dens, what they can call their own. It's very personal, it's very subjective. And often it's not about the end product. It's the process that's important to the children. They could spend all day constructing a den and then knock it down.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen these videos of the children, you know, using hammers and saws and things like that in a completely unstructured kind of way to build whatever they like.
Yeah, children do use tools. We've got hammers, nails, saws. You know, they're capable and they're competent of doing that. They just need the opportunity.
And as part of the destruction cycle, too, they're allowed to build fires, right?
Yeah, we let children play with fire. And I think it's an element that some adults struggle with, and I get that, but the majority of children are fascinated by it. And hopefully, by providing that opportunity to interact with fire, we're actually enabling them to gain a greater understanding and also respect for fire. You know, a burnt finger now may prevent a more serious accident in later life. Hmm. But when we let children play with fire, it's not straight in, you know, it's graduated access till eventually they're controlling that fire. And, you know, I've seen children come on this journey and gain so much confidence, self-esteem, and also social status, you know.
And you do have these people called play workers who kind of hang out in the playground with the kids, right? What's their role?
So as a play worker, you support children's play, and what we're doing is we're compensating children for the lack of adult-free play. A play worker's role is possibly the most difficult, but definitely the most rewarding. As a play worker, you're constantly attuned to everything that's happening. So all your senses are alert and you're risk assessing what they're doing, what the weather's like. So yeah, that's part of the process.
Could you give me an example of like a recent moment when you felt like, okay, now maybe I need to step in, or where you decided not to step in for a given reason?
A little girl that I've worked with for quite a while, we've got metal containers and the children jump off them onto mattresses. It's about 8 foot off the ground, so she's tiny in comparison. So the children make their way up and they climb up wooden pallets to get to the top. And I seen her for days, you know, trying so hard to jump off, and she just couldn't do it. And there was a bit of name calling, and, you know, she took a little bit of flack for not being able to do it. And I think at times like that, it's difficult to not go, you'll be absolutely fine, just jump. And after a few days, she did it. And I tried to hide my delight, although I screamed and she came running towards me and was so proud. And then since then, she's climbed back up and repeated it time and time again until eventually she was impersonating a bird. She was doing it backwards. She was doing flips off it. So, yeah, that was a time when I didn't intervene. And I was so glad because she came to realize that she could do this for herself. I even did it myself.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, how do adults or parents react when they first see the Land? It sounds so unlike other playgrounds that we're used to.
When selling the idea, many parents hold positive play memories. And I think you have to allow and encourage them to reminisce. It's vital. They start to remember what they used to get up to and hear some good stories off some of these parents. And, you know, at the end of the day, what they want for their children is to lead a healthy, happy life. You know, that's where you advocate for what you're doing.
This may sound like a very American question, but do you have parents sign waivers or something before their children come into play on the land? I mean, they're taking risks there.
Yeah, we have registration forms whereby parents fill it in with the child's name, age, any allergies. And on the bottom of it, it says that I allow my child to participate. They may get wet, messy, muddy. But that's not a disclaimer as such. It's more, this is what's going to happen to your child when they come to the land. They're going to get dirty. They're going to get muddy. So it's just letting them know.
So was there a particular moment when you realized that kids in your community in particular needed this kind of free space, whether it's the land or it's the play priority areas?
I felt children should be able to play every day, anytime. You know, it shouldn't just be the holidays. I knew with the land that children can return day after day and they can continue with whatever they were playing if they choose.
So the land and other sites like it, they're called adventure playgrounds, and that they date back, I read, to the 1940s or something like that, when, of course, during and after the Second World War, bravery was kind of this social value. I don't know whether that's the case anymore, but what's the rationale behind letting kids do this kind of adventure play, this risky play?
I think children get socialized in every other corner of their lives. You know, they're told what to do, how to behave. They go to school, they go to clubs, they do different structured activities. And I think sometimes that their playful behavior is interrupted or repressed. And they sit behind or inside this protective shield. So
with parental oversight all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And you know, children need to experience risk to ever be able to overcome it and manage it for themselves.
Do you ever have kids get hurt, get scrapes or bruises or things like that?
Yeah.
And then see them come back? I mean, do they come back to the land in a different kind of way?
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, minor accidents are inevitable, especially when a child starts coming for the first time, because they need to calibrate to the environment. They need to figure out that, oh, actually, if I run down that bank, I'm going to fall. And only a few weeks ago, a little girl came onto the playground and she used a bunch of nettles to climb up the bank.
So
obviously it stung her hand, and it wasn't the end of the world. But she learned from that I won't use them to climb up again.
What do you think kids are losing if their play is limited to kind of safe backyards and rubberized playgrounds?
I think risk is an important part of growing up and an important developmental process for children. And I think they get a sense of personal achievement when they figure out things for themselves, when there's not an adult there telling them how to do something or to do something in a certain way. They get this sense of personal achievement and this increased confidence and self-esteem, as well as, you know, experiencing pleasure and enjoyment.
How did you play as a kid?
Kind of the same. I think I did everything these kids are doing. I played on the land, where the land is now, because I'm from that estate. So I see, you know, that kids are naturally attracted to such a space. And, you know, they still are.
It sounds like fun to me to be a person who stands on the playground and watches kids play and kind of stays out of their way. But it sounds like it would just make my days better. Does it make your days better?
Oh, absolutely. I love it so much. And I think as a play worker, you're not always comfortable. You know, you may feel uneasy if you think rough and tumble is going to turn into real fighting, or if children do have a real fight. You may hate swearing or spitting, for example. But I think what you have to hold on to the fact that our job is to compensate children for the lack of adult-free play. So it's really important that you suspend any of that prejudice and judgment and trust the children that you're serving.
Has it made your days more playful?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Claire Griffiths manages The Land. It's an adventure playground in Wrexham, Wales. She talked with Sarah Nix.
You know, I traveled the world for 30 years for the Wall Street Journal, writing my books, the New York Times, finding left behind people. You know, in Pakistan and Afghanistan and blighted urban cores of America. And at some point we realized the most dramatically left behind person that I had ever met based on the neurological hand he'd been dealt, was living in the bedroom.
That's Ron Susskind talking about his son, Owen. Just before Owen turned 3, he was diagnosed with a rare form of autism, which left him unable or unwilling to speak. He withdrew from everyone, lived in his own silent interior world, until one day there was a breakthrough. Ron and his family discovered that they could draw Owen out, actually get him to talk, by role-playing his favorite Disney film characters. Ron Susskind writes about the experience in his book Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. He tells Steve Paulson about the first signs that Owen was changing.
We had moved to Washington in the fall of 1993. I was moving down to be the senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal, and it was my wife and I, our 2 children. We have an older son, Walter, who's 2.5 years older than Owen. He was 5. Owen was just 2.5 at that point, our little guy. And he was chatting away at 2.5. I love you, let's get ice cream, the normal 2.5-year-old speech. And then he started to lose speech rather dramatically and quickly. In about 2 months, he was down to one word, juice, one word, and was quite inconsolable. He was crying a lot. He was not sleeping. He couldn't make eye contact. And at that point, we were terrified, and we sought out specialists.
Wow. And Owen was eventually diagnosed with regressive autism. What do we know about this disorder?
Well, regressive autism is very much like traditional, let's say, autism. It's genetically coded. There may be some environmental trigger, just like lots of autism. We don't know really the cause so much. But it comes later. So the kids seem typical often in the first year or two. And then somewhere between usually 18 and 36 months, they regress, as it says. And that's startling for the parents, just like it was for us. You have videos of them at 2, and they're smiling and they're laughing, and then they're not. And those videos are ones we eventually couldn't watch.
Do you remember that first day that you got the diagnosis of regressive autism?
Oh, sure. 20 years ago now, but it feels like it was last Tuesday. You can remember it that vividly. The people who, sitting in that chair, as the doctor says, autism, they froze in place, and you start to float above them. And then they explain, look, he may never get his speech back. Many of them don't. You need to think about supporting him for the next 50 years and 30 years after you're dead, probably. And your life will now be different.
Yeah. Now, a big part of this story with Owen is the fascination he developed for Disney films, which has proved to be life-changing. But when you first saw this, when you saw how much he loved watching Disney films, were you kind of worried?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, he liked them like other kids did before the onset of the autism. And his big brother, Walt, 2.5 years older, they all watched them. They watched them a lot. But there was a change after the autism because he was watching them with a kind of intensity. Now, remember, he's not speaking at this point. And so we wondered. We asked our doctors, is this all right? And they said, well, is he joyful? And we said, he seems to be. Well, he's not comfortable almost anywhere else, so it's all right. Don't stop it. And then we start to see he's looking at them with enormous intensity. And then we start to realize something may be going on here.
When did he talk again? When was the next time?
Well, you know, the first moment where we are startled is over the months as he has stopped speaking and when he's 4 years old. You know, he's murmuring some gibberish. You know, he's saying, juicervos, juicervos. And we're watching a movie that he was clearly into at this point, watching it silently, his eyes alight, called The Little Mermaid. And we're all up in the bedroom because this is really the only family activity we can do together. And this part where Ariel, the protagonist, has to trade her voice to become human. And, of course, the sea witch, the villain, says, it won't cost you much, just a trifle, really, just your voice. And Cornelia, we thought he'd been saying, I want more juice. And she was giving him juice, juicervos. She says, it's not juice, it's just. And all of a sudden we see it on the screen, just your voice. And I grab him and I say, oh my God, just your voice. And he's saying, juicervos, juicervos, juicervos. And this is a moment. Walter's brother starts jumping on the bed. Owen's talking again. This is what we called our Annie Sullivan, Helen Keller moment. Of course, the doctors brought us in and sat us down again. You know, this is an education process. And they said, look, this may seem miraculous, but this is called echolalia. The kids who lose speech, like Owen, often develop this, just like what it sounds, echo. They echo noise. I said, so he doesn't know what the words mean. They said, probably not, because the processing, auditory processing, the way you process speech in your brain goes haywire often for autistic kids when this happens. So we were brought down to earth again, bucket of cold water. This goes on for some years where he seems to be verbalizing noises and scripts from the movies, little bits of a few words or a bit of dialogue.
And then something else happened, wasn't it, on Walter's ninth birthday, his brother's ninth birthday.
Absolutely.
And Owen talked again.
Yeah, exactly. And his brother, of course, is a traditional sibling of a disabled kid. He's wildly independent, a junior adult at a very young age. And so we don't much notice that Walter gets emotional on only one day of the year, his birthday. And after this happens on his ninth birthday, Owen, who's saying virtually nothing at this point, a few words, follows us into the kitchen, looks at us intently, and says, Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan.
Wow.
Now, this is like a thunderbolt went through the kitchen. Owen is 6 and a half at this point. You know, he's barely said much, you know, three-word sentences, I want you, give me the ball. And now he's offered a complex sentence of a very complex and nuanced thought. Now, at this moment, you know, he runs off in his private reverie, Owen, whatever he's thinking, and Cornelia and I don't stop talking for 4 hours. You know, how do we get back in? You know, it's like a window opened and we could see him again. And so that night, I go up to his bedroom and I grab one of his puppets. He seemed very intent on a movie called Aladdin. The villain is Jafar, the evil vizier of Agrabah. His villainous sidekick is Iago, the parrot. Well, the parrot puppet is sitting on the floor of Owen's bedroom. I put it on. I crawl up to the edge of the bed. Owen's looking at a book, oblivious to me. And I push the puppet up through the edge of the bedspread. And I talk to him in the voice of Iago. And so I say, Owen, how does it feel to be you? And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, not good. I have no friends and I'm lonely. And this is our first conversation. And we talk, Owen and Iago, the evil puppet. And then after a few minutes, I hear Owen seeming to clear his throat, and he answers back, I love the way your foul little mind works. And that would be Jafar, the villain. And that's the way things went then. A conversation begins between a villain and his evil sidekick. Now, at that point, the Susskind family, the household, turns upside down. Cornelia and I realize he must have memorized all of these scripts and the dialogue and the lyrics, mostly his sound. And if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line.
But the thing is, clearly, I mean, it wasn't just this sort of repeating words. I mean, there was meaning here.
Well, that was our question. How much does he understand? Well, over time, we realized that he was understanding more and more. Because we would play out the scenes, and it wasn't just mimicry. He seemed to be channeling the emotions of the characters. And so this begins what we called the basement sessions in our house, where we played out scenes from all the Disney movies, about 20 of them that were clearly Owen's special favorites. And everyone joined in, his older brother, Cornelia, me, and we became Disney characters. So here we were living a traditional Washington life. Cornelia's driving Owen to every therapy session she can find. Walter's going to school. I'm going to the Wall Street Journal Bureau every day. But at night, we become animated characters. Over years, this is how he gets his speech back, little by little.
I mean, so this is what you did for years to play these characters.
Yeah.
Your whole family did.
Yeah, my whole family. Yeah. I mean, you know, of course, I lived a public life otherwise. I was writing books about presidents, interviewing them, wrestling with them in public on television shows. And then I led this other life So one day I'd be talking about George Bush and Dick Cheney, and the next day I'd be in the basement meditating on evil with Owen about which villain was the most pernicious and evil. And we even at one point talked about Bush and Cheney, where Owen was trying to make connections. I said, don't go there, buddy. Don't go there.
Just to hear you just tell the story, I mean, it's it almost sends chills down my spine. I mean, it's like you're describing a kid who, you know, really couldn't talk, couldn't articulate, and then suddenly he comes out with these profound things.
You know what? Here's what we find. You know, Owen now is almost 23, just turned 23, and we know lots and lots of kids that we've met over the years with affinities that are quite deep. And when they're nourished, when they're encouraged, we find surprising things occur, that they are doing things not dissimilar to what Owen does. It's often not recognized because there's kind of no place for it in either therapy or education. But, you know, they're creating a language. Some kids speak map. Some kids speak train schedule. Some kids speak anime. But they're using it to find their way in the world. And this is the great the lesson that Owen teaches us. Owen's older brother, Walter, says it best. He says, Owen is my best teacher. And in some ways, that's part of what happened. We worldwise folks, like me and my wife, you know, I've taught at famous colleges and all of that mumbo jumbo. Owen has been our teacher. A kid, mind you, with a measurable IQ of 75. And to put IQ scores on these kids, there should be a law against that. But he's got that tattoo to his arm, like many kids do, because they are so untraditional in how they express their essence, their ability, that they get discarded. And for Owen, that means here's a mop, mop till you die and be happy. We're actually finding a powerful counterpoint to that. And now specialists are joining us. Leading autism researchers are saying, you know, these affinities are actually more pathway, we think, than prison.
So you're saying that that Owen's story has actually changed the way people, the so-called experts, think about autism and what to do about it?
I sit here surprised to report this. I am an investigative reporter. I am skeptical of everything. But that, in fact, is the case.
I would think the big question would be whether Owen could sort of move from this role-playing fictional world dealing with these imaginary characters from Disney films, whether that translates to the real world and actually how he interacts with other people. Did that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's really happened just in the last 3 years. He left home 3 years ago to go to a college-like program on Cape Cod for folks with various challenges, many of them on the autism spectrum. And of course, the first thing he does when he gets there, he starts Disney Club because he needs friends. He's often been friendless, and now he says, I need to find friends. And it's very heartening because they have found a community of shared purpose and shared affinity. And from there, relationships are growing quickly.
So when you think about Owen's future now, are you worried, concerned, hopeful?
You know, we will always be concerned. He is autistic. He will always be autistic. This is not a spell that gets broken. It's a way of being. And the challenges keep coming. But, you know, I think we are more hopeful than we ever could have imagined, because what we're finding is that he has built a toolkit from his own special affinity and, of course, from the love and support of the family and his friends and the therapists, where he's able to sort of make his way, at least more and more without us. Someday it will be without us. And we can see a time where that will work out okay. And he has his brother, who recently in an interview said, look, I can see someday I'll be 70 and Owen will be 68 and he'll live near me. You know, I'll check up on him and see him all the time. And at that point, Walter's confident they'll be talking about a lot more than just Disney. They're already doing some of that.
Ron Susskind is the author of Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. He and Steve had a much longer conversation, which you can hear on our website at ttbook.org. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, making school more fun by bringing video games into the classroom. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about the power of play in this hour. And here's a sound that's probably familiar to you. I'm not much of a gamer myself, but I do have teenagers, and they have a PS4 and an Xbox on which they have logged some serious hours. According to one estimate, the average young person spends a total of 8 hours a week playing video games. That's the equivalent of more than 2 weeks a year. All that mindless screen time, that cannot be good for growing brains. But as it turns out, new research is finding social and psychological benefits to gaming. And now, a new generation of educators wants to bring video games into the classroom. Journalist Greg Topo covers this new development in his book, The Game Believes in You: How Digital Play Can Make Our Kids Smarter. He talked with Raymond Tunkekar.
I think games can be used to encourage kids to do pretty much anything. A good game, whether it's an academic game or, you know, any kind of game, it really is all about presenting material in a very clear and unfettered way. You know, one of the folks that I talked to in the book, he has what I think is probably the best analogy. He says, you know, let's say you're trying to teach math, for instance. You know, a good video game is, in a sense, kind of like a piano for math. It allows you to sort of play math and play in, you know, sort of both senses of the word, play as in a musical instrument and also play as in play around with it.
Hmm. And as you point out, there's a long history of education advocates wanting to use games as a classroom aid.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we think that it's a very recent phenomenon. And I guess it's recent in this particular iteration. That is, I would say it's only been in the past maybe 10 or 12 years that people have been really thinking about it in a big way. But, you know, the effort has been kind of chugging along at a very low level for, I would say, at least 40 years. You know, one of the things that I think about is sort of the big educational game was something like the Oregon Trail. And, you know, what people may not know is that the first eighth graders to play that game were doing it in 1971. So that, you know, they're now in their mid-50s. So it's been a while since people have been thinking about this kind of thing.
Well, and I grew up playing that game, too. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what it was trying to teach me, other than that squirrels are harder to shoot than bison.
Okay. I guess that's not an idea you had when you started, right? But in terms of, you know, what it taught you, I mean, I think it taught one important thing that really came almost by accident, and that is something called systems thinking. Systems thinking is essentially training the mind to think about the world in terms of systems, in terms of how things are built. So what would happen when you started the Oregon Trail, if you remember, the first thing it asked you was, how would you like to eat? And it gave you three choices, right? Mm-hmm. Well, moderately, and poorly. And, you know, you could just sort of mindlessly click one or the other. But what it immediately asks you to do is think, what are the implications of that? And how will this game play out differently if I choose one over the other? And maybe if I choose one this time, I'll choose another the next time and see, you know, how things work out. So it was really introducing you. I mean, think about how young you might have been playing that game. It was really introducing you to systems in a kind of an effortless way.
And reading the book, I mean, that was a surprising revelation for me. It kind of led me to view video games less as a pleasurable activity and more as a vehicle for actually transmitting information, specifically like making models of different worlds, which video games seem to really excel at.
I think that's right. And actually, you know, the central idea, if you will, of this book is that games introduce something called hard fun. And that's an actual sort of video game term. And what it means is that, yes, you're having fun. Yes, you're enjoying yourself, but you're also doing something really difficult. And a good game will sort of build until you're doing something that you maybe even didn't think you could do. You know, we like to think of video gamers as sort of slackers, right? I mean, my understanding was really that they were slackers going into this. I mean, I didn't really know much about this world, even though I was sort of a casual gamer. What I came away with at the end was that gamers aren't sort of eternal slackers. I think they're eternal strivers in a way. And that was really a revelation for me.
Well, you know, I have no children myself, but I do have friends whose children spend hours a day playing video games. And, you know, it's getting to the point where it's starting to kind of affect their grades. I mean, shouldn't we be concerned that bringing games into the classroom only reinforces this type of bad behavior?
Yeah, I guess. Well, I mean, I'd push back a little bit on the idea that it's bad behavior, mostly because when you're playing a game, I mean, you're not just sort of kicking back and just vegging out. I mean, you're really working hard at something. So the kind of work that you're doing when you're playing a game, I mean, it's really active. It's really, you know, you're challenging sort of your mental faculties. So in a sense, we just really need to sort of rethink what we're asking kids to do. I mean, in a sense, that's what a video game does in the end. It allows the player, whether they're a kid or an adult, to do something sort of epic. And if that's the only opportunity that someone has in their day to do something epic, I wouldn't blame the game. I would blame the rest of, you know, the other 22 hours of their life.
And I suppose also, in a way, it teaches them how to fail.
Absolutely. And that's a skill we've lost in a big way, the ability to fail well and come back and give it another shot. You know, there's a whole book in that, in terms of, you know, the healthy attitude that games give people in terms of failure.
In the book, you talk about how games have built-in ways of actually testing student comprehension. Do you think video games could replace standardized tests and other ways of testing students?
I actually do. I mean, I don't think we're there yet, but when you think about what a good game does, I mean, I don't know if you're a gamer, but, you know, one of the things that gamers really love is that games set out a task, ask you to do the task, and evaluate you, right? It really is one big test. And the final product is you either did well or did poorly, and we're going to tell you exactly, step by step, minute by minute, how well you did. That's what testing is about, right? The problem is they don't always do it very well. So, you know, as one researcher says in my book, you know, if I make it through all the levels of Halo, you don't need to give me a test at the end to ask me how well I know Halo. The test is done. I just did it. And I think that's got some really, really huge potential for school, because in a way it could sort of make testing as we know it obsolete. I would give it maybe 4 or 5 years. I think we're going to see a very, very different kind of assessment for kids in school.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like what you're doing with this book is you're kind of pushing back against this idea that there isn't any value to gaming beyond pleasure. And, you know, I was really surprised to find out that there were all sorts of benefits games have. You actually write about gaming as a sort of therapy for children with attention deficit disorders.
And that was actually a surprise to me. I mean, that was not something I knew about going into this. It was actually something I just found out about doing my reporting. You know, it really, I actually have played some of these games.
Oh, really? What are they like?
Well, I think, you know, most of them are still sort of in the early stages, but they're on their way, and I think they're getting pretty good. I actually just played a new version of one over the weekend. And what it does is it asks you to put on this headband, this EEG headband. And essentially what it does is it reads your brain waves minute to minute. So you're playing the game on a laptop, but your hands are not on the keys or not on the mouse pad or trackpad. You're controlling the game with your brain. And in this case, what you're doing is you're controlling how fast the character in this game runs. And you can do that essentially by focusing on the character themselves. And I will say, you know, like I said, I don't have ADD, but when I took that headband off after about 20 minutes, I mean, I had this sort of interesting sort of clarity of mind. It really felt like a yoga workout or something that I had just come out of.
It's kind of remarkable to think that your doctor in the future could regularly prescribe 15 minutes of gameplay a day or something.
That's right. That's actually what the goal is. They're sort of this quiet foot race to create a prescription strength video game. And I mean that quite literally, that your doctor could pull out their prescription pad and say, you know, instead of one pill of Adderall, you need to play this game for 20 minutes or half an hour a day. So it's sort of a brave new world out there.
I'm just thinking about how central play is to the way we learn, right? I mean, children clearly mimic adults and learn certain skills through play. You talk about this long history of education advocates trying to bring games into the classroom. Why is the idea of fun so foreign a concept in schools today?
You know, I think we just have this sort of American Puritan idea that fun and achievement are sort of on two ends of the spectrum. And I want to be careful to say that I don't think good teachers think that. I think if you remember the best teachers you had, they understood that, you know, learning something really hard can be fun. But I think the system in general has lost this idea. And, you know, the thing that I say in the book is that, you know, we really just need to sort of shake this idea and just kind of take the advice of some really good teachers, really good game designers, and try to think about where the fun is in really, really hard things. And I think we, you know, we'll get better results in the end.
Greg Toppo covers education for USA Today. His book is The Game Believes in You. Raymond Tangekar talked with him. That's it for now. But if you like what you heard this hour, subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And if you really want to help us out, leave a review. That helps other people hear about the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tangekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, Charles Monroe Kane, and Emma Ryskowski. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Special thanks to Joe Hartke for remixing the version you're hearing now. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.